session number 11744, rule 3.
Now, we had this brilliant idea of again copying the Germans. Go back to your finger four and our fixed formation flying. All the way across the Low Countries, France, right the way into Germany, the Germans had great banks of searchlights. They were controlled from one master searchlight, which theoretically the people called a blue one. But once you got fixed with a blue searchlight, the entire bank would form up on you and then follow you across, going from bank of searchlight to bank of searchlight. We hadn't got the same amount of time, but we had got radar. Now, through East Anglia, we laid out masses upon masses of searchlights. At the sector station end, in other words, inland, not near the coast, we put up a searchlight that steadily flashed a Morse letter. So you'd have A, B, C, and so on. We then took a fighter, or a series of fighters, usually three, and stepped them up 500 feet or so apart above searchlight A, searchlight B, and so on. Off the coast, we had our normal run of fighters patrolling, trying to intercept bombers on normal radar interception, ground control interception. The searchlights were controlled by an army officer and by a stooge of a sergeant, that was me in one case, so you can imagine it. When the searchlights were told to illuminate, we'd have our fighters up over the top and ready. Now, the searchlight officer could obviously see where the targets were coming in through the east coast. We both sat over a cathode ray tube that had a sodium base. It must have been about twice the size of an ordinary coffee table. And that, instead of giving a blue blip as a normal cathode ray tube would do, gave a sort of dull greyish one. Didn't make much odds, but there it was. But the great thing about it was that this particular cathode ray tube was horizontal, so that you'd get a whole lot of blokes sitting over the top of it, looking down on it and seeing what worked. Again, it was a brilliant idea that didn't work. We hadn't got the range to do our dirty work. You imagine, by the time you got into the Hook of Holland, let's say, worked your way back through Holland, right the way through Aachen, right the way through to the Ruhr and so on, they had a hell of a deep bank of searchlights to deal with. We had just, 80 miles, if that? It wasn't enough. So it didn't work terribly well. However, we pressed on with it because it encouraged the civilians, presumably, to see all these things, our own fighters and various things flashing about in the searchlights and hearing mosquitoes by that time sort of howling their way through. We also had a lot of fun and frolic.
This is about 43, was it? Oh, no.
What am I? 42, I should think. Sorry, dates don't mean a thing to me. I can't even remember my own birthday. Miss must have been getting on towards that. At that time, we were putting really heavy raids on, and of course we had the dam busters and that sort of thing, you know. And of course we provided cover for those people. Now, our next trick was to annoy the Junkers 88s that were fitted up with their version of AI. So we would send our mosquitoes way over towards the Dutch islands. We would have from, I think it was from the Y service by way of group, information from the German controllers to their fighters. In other words, somebody would listen in to them, give us an immediate translation as to what was happening. They undoubtedly were listening to us, talking to our night fighters, getting an immediate translation there. And it was like playing three-dimensional chess, as you can imagine. We knew what they were thinking and saying, they knew what we were thinking and saying, and we were trying to intercept their 88s over their own particular patch. I don't know if we ever knocked anything down. Difficult to tell. But what we did do, of course, was to operate, was to take their controller's mind off bombers. You can imagine it, can't you? And their fighters were not too happy at the thought of having a cannon-firing bow fighter or a vast mosquito sort of knocking hell out of the back of them while they were busy. Life went on fairly placidly for a long time. We played that game. Then I was pushed down to Hornchurch for a bit, for no known reason as far as I could find out. I complained bitterly at going back to work in an operations room because it was a bit boring after a time. Because if you were dealing with night fighters, which we were to a large extent, your controlling technique became much more rapid and much more personal. Take your Hotspur 2-4. I forget our own particular call sign, but I'll use Kenway because that was one that I used when we were mobile. Hotspur 2-4, this is Kenway, over. Yes, receiving you. 100 patrol vector. Okay. Angels 20. Okay. Port 010, patrol vector. Okay. We have a target for you. Turn starboard onto 180. 180. Your target is possibly friendly. Speed 180, course 240. He will be crossing you port starboard, and you talk him down into that with that short transmission each time. You hadn't got time to mess about. Particularly if you were fool enough to get yourself into a head-on interception situation where you had two aircraft coming head-on to each other at about 400 miles apiece, and if you swung them round too early, you put your fighter straight in front of the opposition's guns, and if you put them round too late, he couldn't catch the opposition, particularly if it was 190. Oh, incidentally, talking of 190s, sorry about this, I could have butterfly brain, I'm sorry.
That's all right.
Two things. 190 started raiding southern England in a big way, carrying just one bomb, or as being a darn nuisance at night. Cunningham managed to shoot two or three down. He was an incredible man. But there was one night when they came across, and for some reason, I think the station chance light at Westmorling was the same as the one on the other side of the channel. And two 190s got themselves well and truly lost, landed at Westmorling, and nipped into the duty pilot, who was horrified. You can imagine having a couple of German pilots arriving. But we had one night when the intelligence people told us that plus or minus so many nights of the moon, one of the German Pathfinder equivalents was going to raid Chelmsford and knock off the ball bearing works there. And duly, we sat about and said, oh, nonsense. Sorry, one always did. But I was acting as duty officer that day, and there'd been a hockey match, and I was down at the Orwell in Felixstowe, the local pub, having a drink with the opposition team of hockey players, and heard 190s howling overhead, thought something was wrong immediately, pedalled up to Trimley Heath, which was miles up the road on the good old Air Force bicycle, over the top of me, doing a nice steady 180 at about 50 feet. I'll swear that if the rear gunner had pushed his guns down, well, he could have taken my hat off, went in a Junkers treble one, a Heinkel treble one, K. It just sort of went up the main road. Now, there was a lot of kerfuffle because they bombed the power station just as I arrived at Ipswich. And our power, our standby power, is a bit slow coming on. But in the meantime, we got some bow fighters up from 12 Group. I managed to warn our Spitfires that there were friendlies about, and for God's sake, be careful! And one of our, we got a telephone call from irate bow fighter pilot saying that one of our blasted mosquitoes had shot him down. Apparently he got out in a parachute and walked to the nearest telephone, and he was hotly pursued by his observer. We had a chap called Sergeant Tony Smith, who was brilliant, lovely controller, and he'd heard this rumour of their Pathfinder mob. He got a couple of blips coming out in the middle of the North Sea. One of the fools had gone up to take a tail bearing on something on the Dutch Islands, you know, to get a dead accurate fix. Dipped down again. Tony did a lot of guesswork. Got a sergeant, got a flying officer, forget his name, doesn't matter. Probably as well if I don't tell you. But he shot down one of three treble ones immediately. The second one put his mosquito on fire, so he shot him down, then had a go at the third one and damaged him. Landed burning at Bradwell. And walked away from it. The next day he went back to Westmorling, where he was based, and flew straight into Bluebell Hill, and that was the end of him, which was sheer bad luck at his DFC and his coffin and within 24 hours. But at any rate, that sort of thing was always quite exciting, as far as we were concerned. Very boring for you. For some reason, I was pushed back to Hornchurch. It was probably because I was a damned awful controller. That seems the obvious thought, but they lent me to Channel Stop for a couple of nights.
To Channel Stop?
Yeah, Stop, where you went down to a place just outside Dover. What the devil's the name of the...
Hawkins?
No, no, there was a radar station on St Margaret's Bay. Forget the name of it, doesn't matter. But there you could see the convoys going up and down the channel.
This is not Capel Lafon, is it?
Very close to that, but there is a radar station just there. I'll probably remember the name of it sometime when you've gone. In broad daylight, in broad moonlight, you could bop the opposition with cannon-firing hurricanes. In this sort of weather, you know, thick cloud, no moon, you flew swordfish at them and either torpedoed them or... all good, clean fun. But as soon as you started transmitting, the Germans knew that something was amiss and they started shelling you, which was very annoying. But ultimately I went back to Trimley Heath. Everybody else was fed up with me, I don't doubt. And from there I heard from a friend of mine that they were putting radar stations into trucks and using those mobiles, and they were going to Normandy, or certainly going abroad. Well, it seemed the obvious thing to do, to go and join them, didn't it? So I went up to Church Fenton and learnt to be a mobile controller, learnt to be a tame combined operations sergeant instead of an ordinary sergeant, learned to drive all sorts of lorries and trucks and things. and in the fullness of time came down to Salisbury Plain and went to Normandy by way of who the devil is it that runs a motor museum down at oh, just
a lord.
Yes. Well, I went off from near there and went to Normandy.
Lord
and
Montague.
Montague, that's right, Beeler. I went into Normandy with the Americans, which was dangerous, because we'd done a little training with them dressed in khaki. We did our landing in Air Force Blue. And once you get Air Force Blue salty and damp, a bit of sand on it, the Germans shot at us because they knew who we were. The Americans shot at us because they knew that everything that looked grey-blue was German. And we had a very uncomfortable little time there. Now, if you can imagine the difficulties of putting radar sets into lorries and carting them across rough ground, God knows how it worked, but it didn't. It worked beautifully. We had all sorts of people that were devoted to the game. They enjoyed doing it, apart from the controllers. You know, the technical bods thought of putting quarts into pint pots, you know, and changing masses upon masses of trays of valves into strange little trays of new types of valves and things. We had Canadians, Australians, a New Zealander called Ross Gricks, who was half Maori, I think. He was Maori mad. And he used to go into pubs when there was a terrible shortage of beer and do a harker, and people thought he was having an epileptic fit or something. He used to clear off and leave the pub to us, which is all very handy. We galloped about in Normandy doing all sorts of things and tried to cover the guards armoured on their way up to Arnhem. We didn't do very well. And we'd by that time learnt again from the Germans that aircraft are remarkably good artillery. So we started mobile controlling. You know, you'd nip along in a jeep. You'd have a map. The aircraft behind you would have a corresponding map. They'd set up a cab rank above a church or something. You'd bring them in to deal with whatever target you'd got. Or else they'd go off on their own and they'd have another lot relieve them, you see. All very good, clean fun. But in the end, we were sent back to England because our gear was out of date and badly knocked about. So we went back to Ringwood, near Hants. And there we found ourselves a bed. We were most unpopular. We were on an old peacetime station with one warrant officer, three sergeants, and about four airmen. And they suddenly got this strange collection of combined ops people land on their doorstep. The next day, most of our officers vanished even more quickly than we did. A flight sergeant there, who used to be a fly poster for Alan Cobham, and I loaded up a couple of three-tonners with the crews. We gave them their travel vouchers and stuff and sent them off on leave. We then took our three-tonners back to Ringwood, stole a 1,500-weight truck, drove round the airfield until we could see some poor airman who said, "No, I can't drive a 1,500-weight, so we told him, "Now's your chance to learn." We took the thing down to the station and presumably he brought it back to Ringwood because he wasn't posted as missing when we got home. Now, I was lucky. I went up to Blyth in Northumberland, where my father was on a submarine base by that time, and I'd actually got a son. I was tickled pink about that. Padre came round with some letters just after we arrived in Normandy, and the first one I got was, "Your son is now 10 days old. Where the hell are you?" you know, all my letters have been going into a bag. And at any rate, our house down in New Eltham had been clouted by the second buzz bomb that came over. Didn't improve things at all, or my wife's temper, or the baby clothes and stuff, you can imagine. But at any rate, it was a super leave. I can remember it well. We christened young Christopher in my father's wardroom, and they had all sorts of odd bodge. They had one of the submarine VCs and several other people there, and it really was a magnificent party. My father managed to get me a trip on a training submarine. I'd never been in one, you know, apart from looking over the top of them. Fascinated by it. And a trip down a coal mine as well. But we went back to Ringwood at the end of this lot, and they had a whole lot of people that were highly trained, as you can imagine, and didn't know what the hell to do with them. So some of us formed up into another unit and went back again to go through the Ruhr, you know, after the Rhine crossing happened, and go on to the southern part of Germany. And I was much more fortunate, in fact. I was sent up to Malvern, which was a telecommunication research establishment in Malvern College, which was a most incredible place. Now, I'm no mathematician, and I'm not very bright anyway, but there you had the science laboratories absolutely crammed full with mathematicians. There were people, there was a botanist there who'd worked out a circuit that would convert slant height into a ground position, which was incredibly clever and brilliant. He didn't know how to repair his own radio set. When that was wrong, he sent it down to the village shop to be repaired. But he could do strange things with mathematics, and they had a damn good lab technician. But if you can imagine a nice old Victorian building like that Malvern school, you didn't walk very close to the walls, because if you did, there'd be a cry of fury from above you, and somebody had lobbed three-quarters of a radar set out of the window because it wouldn't work. You were liable to be, well, certainly discouraged by a large lump about the size of that television set suddenly arriving at you.
What were you yourself doing at TRE?
They had worked out a theory that we could cart a centimetric set instead of a metric one about the countryside, and it was a brilliant device. It worked, it's a long time ago, I think it was about 9 centimeter wavelength. It worked on the same way that I believe present day sets work, that you had the same sweep like a second hand going round to show you what was happening. But instead of having a map printed onto the face of it, you had a superimposed spider's web. In other words, you had strobe marks that gave you marks every 5 degrees or so, 10 degrees. You had other strobe marks that gave you mileage. In other words, 5, 10, 15, 20. Now, this device, being centimetric, gave you a range of about 120 miles each way. Now, you didn't want 120 miles each way. In other words, if you put the spot in the centre, you've got 120 miles to the west of you that was no use. 120 miles to the east of you that was very useful. If you move the centre about, in other words, if you move the centre of the sweep back to the west, you got your same range eastward where you could use it. You could then, if you wanted to, enlarge or diminish the scale of the range, so that if you really wanted to, you could work over a 10-mile range. and you could do some very delicate fiddling with aeroplanes on that distance. You can imagine it. Our job, we were there as users. We were the people that had to use it. Therefore, we were the people that had to tell them that we couldn't possibly do that. How the hell do you expect us to? You know what I mean?
Yes.
And they were terribly sensible about it. We also had to put this thing into a vast marquee. I'll tell you a bit more about that later. Now, every so often, Saturday mornings, they'd hold a Soviet, where somebody would get up on his hind legs, usually a genius, and propose something, some very clever thought. And he'd cover a blackboard or two with miles upon miles of formulae, whereupon somebody at the back of the room would get up and say, "It's obvious to the meanest intelligence that that can never work." And he would also go to the blackboard and say, "It's all wrong." By the same token, when we got our set, they showed us this thing, and we thought, "Gord." And the next move was, now we're going to use it for controlling, we're going to use it for reporting. It will give us range, it'll give us range and bearing. Now, as I say, my father was in the Navy. I'd done a fair amount of sailing, and that was sheer heresy as far as I was concerned. Because if you're going to report anything, first thing you do is to report the bearing, because then you know which line to look along. Then you put the range when you get across. If you give a range, you're looking through 360 degrees. I'm sorry, it's obvious, but it wasn't to somebody that didn't know where to look, if you follow me. We saw the thing built. We went down to London, to the Old Kent Road, and picked up an enormous marquee, and we learnt to put that up and down. Now, one strange thing about wartime and the Air Force and lots of other things is that coincidence comes into it in a big way. I used to be a Rover Scout, you know, when we had such things. I used to run Rover Scouts in Eltham as well. But pre-war, I was a Rover Scout when we took part in the gang show at the Scala, when the Scouts used to do that. They also used to put on a show in the Albert Hall called the Boy Scout. And I was one of the idiots with a hobby horse. You know, the sort of thing, a long pole with them. And we ran round and round the Albert Hall on that thing. And there was one particular cunning blighter called Gratwick, charming bloke. He had a bicycle and he rode round on that thing. He was at TRE with us. And because he was an ex-Rover Scout, he and I got lumbered with this marquee. It's not funny putting up a large marquee. It takes thought. You know, you've got winches and all sorts of clever things to help you. So we decided how we could do it, and we got a whole collection of airmen on to join in with this thing, and we practiced, and we got it down to a couple of hours or so, which wasn't bad going, rather like Cotterill Circus, you know. I'd run across my friend Gratwick before, because he'd had an operation on his toes